because it's a requirement to engage industry, particularly employers, as part of that state plan. So the employers can help drive the vision, drive the engagement, and how they want to see the workforce develop.
Hi, I'm Jim Doyle, President of Business Forward, and you're listening to the Business Forward podcast. Business Forward helps local business leaders fix Washington by bringing Washington to them. Subscribe to our podcast to hear conversations with policy experts, elected officials, and business leaders about important issues like climate action and affordable healthcare.
In this episode, Business Forward hosted a discussion on labor shortages. In this conversation with Business Forward Executive Director Liz Fairchild, officials from the U.S. Department of Education and the Department of Labor discussed current labor shortages, including school staffing shortages and apprenticeship programs, and how small businesses can get involved. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Hello, everyone. I'm Liz Fairchild, Executive Director of Business Forward. Today, we are so pleased to continue our education and workforce development series with our guest today. We're joined by Manny Lamar, the Senior Advisor at the U.S. Department of Labor, and Maureen Tracy Mooney, Senior Advisor at the U.S. Department of Education. Today, we're going to be touching upon current labor shortages, including school staffing shortages, apprenticeship programs, and how business leaders like you can get involved. We'll also be answering a number of the questions that you submitted when you registered for the briefing. So again, thank you for your questions. So again, thank you all for joining us today. And Manny, we're going to start with your opening remarks.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And again, Manny Lamar, Senior Advisor at the Department of Labor, the Employment and Training Administration. First, thank you so much, Liz and the team, for inviting us. We appreciate the invite and always welcome to engage with your stakeholders. So thank you again. Just really quickly, I think for the opening remarks, the main thing I'll highlight is two things. One is how we're thinking about and the why now that how we're thinking about engagement within, we're talking about the labor shortage, but we see this around a broader kind of opportunity. So in particular, we know that we want to, there's a changing labor market. I know a variety of you have heard around changes since post-pandemic, but I think when we look at kind of take a step back, but there's a broader kind of changes that's come about post-pandemic. But quite frankly, some of those things have existed within the labor market that the administration, the Department of Labor, that we do see a whole government approach to really think strategically about making a change. Two, when we're thinking about the broader changes, there's also implications with new legislation. So when we think about the bipartisan infrastructure law, the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS and Science Act, all of those legislation and many more, quite frankly, really provides an opportunity to really make a meaningful difference within the labor market and really to transform kind of legacy systems and really impact programs and policies that makes a change, bring more individuals to the labor market, ensuring that those individuals are positioned to have good jobs. You'll hear a lot about, and you may already be familiar with our job quality initiatives and priorities, but one is bringing more individuals to the labor market. Two, ensuring that they have access to good jobs, quite frankly. And three, that when we're talking about those good jobs, it is distributed equitably and ensure that a variety of populations are able to engage. And with that, you know, I also want to mention that within ETA, the vision or the mission of ETA is really, quite frankly, to improve the functioning of the U.S. economy. We do this through a variety of high quality job training, employment, income assistance, and labor market information. So we do these through a variety of strategies. And in particular, we have programs and policies that really kind of helps us operationalize this. We recently launched an ETA 2030 vision. And the ETA 2030 vision really kind of builds on those key kind of principles that I talked about, the why now in terms of the changing labor market, in terms of the strength transforming legacy systems, taking advantage of these opportunities, of these massive legislation that the administration has been building on around good jobs and equity, and quite frankly, the need for new leadership to really engage in these space. And that vision or those four guiding pillars for the ETA 2030 vision pillars, they are really four things. The first one is, and you'll again hear some of these themes, but this is what drives all of our work. And even later as we engage in discussions, they underlie a lot of this, our response. One is opening up opportunities for vulnerable workers and communities. That's quite frankly about ensuring our programs focus on workers and communities who have been left behind, quite frankly. That includes reentry, that includes rural communities, that include opportunity youth. So we have a whole youth strategy that we can speak about as well, and many others. Two, and this is particularly relevant for this group, is new industry partnerships that leads to real good jobs. So we talk about industry partnership. We know that when we talk about good jobs, when we talk about training, industry has to be at the table. And when we talk about industry, we're talking about employers, from and not just large employers, but small and medium-sized employers. How can we engage strategically and support across our programs, whether we're talking about apprenticeships or we're talking about other workforce sector strategies and other programs, but partnering with business, including labor at the table as we engage in a variety of sector initiatives, infrastructure, supply chains, manufacturing, education, and so forth. The third thing is around building a better care economy. We do have a focus here within ECA around the care economy. We saw this coming. We see that there's a consistent thread. We're thinking about issues around mental health, healthcare. How are individuals positioned? What are the wraparound services, quite frankly, that workers need to be successful in the labor market? So that kind of underlies one of that area around the care economy. And then the fourth one is taking action today for the future of work. And so really what that is, it's both an inside and an outside strategy, because it's both internally, and I'll speak to some of these later and some of the questions around how are we modernizing and enhancing our systems. For example, which you'll hear about our registered apprenticeship, how we've been able to scale apprenticeship within occupations, particularly for teachers, to address career pathway opportunity. But it also includes externally, how are we taking a sense, looking at engaging with stakeholders to really position opportunities for individuals to succeed in the labor market. So I'll conclude, but I'll just synthesize by kind of restating those four things. One is opening up opportunities for vulnerable workers and communities. Two, building a better care economy. Three is industry partnerships that leads to real good jobs. And then four, taking action today for the future of work. And all of those things, the key kind of consistent themes are around job quality, building good jobs, two, equity, and then three, partnerships. And I'll stop there and turn it over to you, Liz.
Thank you so much, Manny. And ETA is Department of Labor's Employment and Training Administration, just for anyone who didn't catch it at the very beginning. So thank you for outlining
the acronyms.
So many acronyms. Yes, we appreciate it. Maureen, I'd love to hear what you're doing over at Department of Education.
Thank you, Liz. And thanks, Manny. It's always wonderful to hear you talk about the Department of Labor's work. So here at the U.S. Department of Education, we believe that high quality public education from pre-kindergarten through post-secondary training and beyond lifts up communities, unites people around student success, strengthens our democracy, grows our economy, and empowers people everywhere to realize their dreams. That's why we're committed to ensuring that all our students receive an education that enables them to thrive, both in school, in career, and in their lives. So earlier this year, the department launched Raise the Bar, Lead the World, which is the department's call to action to transform our P-12 education system and unite around what truly works, based on decades of experience and research to advance educational equity and excellence. And our work on Raise the Bar really has three key goals. First, to achieve academic excellence. And within that, we're prioritizing accelerating learning for every student, as well as delivering a comprehensive and rigorous education for every student. We know that the impacts of the pandemic on our students' learning have been significant. And from passing the American Rescue Plan, which has surged $122 billion to our nation's schools to support tutoring, mentoring, and a range of other supports, to actions we're taking every day through our normal grant programs and actions, we're really focused on how do we make sure that we're addressing the impacts of the pandemic. The second big goal is boldly improving learning conditions. And that includes eliminating educator shortages for every school and investing in every student's mental health and well-being. Again, these are two areas that were significantly impacted by the pandemic, as I'll talk about a little bit more in a moment. And then our third big goal under Raise the Bar is to create pathways for global engagement by doing two things: ensuring every student has a pathway to college and career, and providing every student with a pathway to multilingualism. We know in our increasingly connected world that it's so important that our young people are getting opportunities and exposure to college and career well before they've graduated from high school, and really getting those work-based learning experience credentials before they graduate. And that also being able to speak a second language is so incredibly valuable right now to succeed in our international and competitive economy. So of course, today we're talking a bit about labor shortages. So I'll focus there for a moment, just to kind of frame up the rest of our conversation today in terms of the teacher shortage piece of this. So from February to May of 2020, we lost 730,000 local public education jobs. So just from February to May of those first few months of the pandemic, we lost 730,000 local public education jobs. To put that number in perspective, that's 9% of all those local public education, largely school-based jobs. That's huge. Because of the investments in the American Rescue Plan and aggressive action by states, the federal government, local communities, we've now recovered 84% of those jobs. So that's good progress. If you look at where we are now to where we were before the pandemic, we now have only 1.5% fewer folks in those roles, as opposed to that initial 9% drop. So that's good. However, we know that recovery has varied significantly from state to state, and that we also have serious underlying shortages coming into the pandemic that disproportionately impacted students of color, English learners, students with disabilities. And it's really critical that we go after and address all of those shortages so that every school has the supports that they need. As we think about how we're addressing those shortages, we have a couple key strategies that I wanted to lift up for you. The first is increasing teacher compensation and working conditions. We know that unless our educators are paid competitively, we're going to continue to see the persistent shortages that we've seen so far. Our educators should not have to choose between pursuing a career in education and being able to support their family. We're not going to have a successful education system if that's the way we're going. So we need critical action in that space. Second, we need high quality and affordable pathways into the teaching profession. And both of those pieces are really important. We're not going to get high quality education for our students unless we are prepared, our educator preparation programs are high quality, have robust clinical experience. And two, we have to tackle the affordability challenge. Too many of our prospective teachers can't afford to become a teacher. And we know that that disproportionately impacts Black and Latino young people who are more likely to have higher levels of student debt and are therefore doing the math on becoming a teacher and just don't see how the numbers add up. So we need to take away that affordability barrier in order to broaden the pipeline and diversify our profession. Third, we need high quality induction and professional learning. So yes, when we talk about shortages, we can't just increase the folks coming into the profession, but we have to keep and support the people that we have. So providing our new teachers with really high quality support and supporting our teachers throughout their career so that they can continue to grow and develop. Five, really prioritizing leadership and advancement opportunities for teachers. We know some teachers are happy to be in the classroom for 30 years, and that's incredible, while others need to see a career pathway that provides additional opportunities for leadership. And then finally, educator diversity along the entire career of an educator. We don't see educator diversity as something that we're doing sort of on the side or siloed, but as something that's really woven throughout all of our efforts. So I want to drill down just for a second, if it's okay, on apprenticeship. It's quite possible that the folks on this call know a lot more about registered apprenticeship programs than some of our schools do. Sometimes our education and workforce systems are just too separated from one another, and this administration is doing a ton of work to build that gap. And as a result, one of our key strategies for eliminating educator shortages is really expanding apprenticeship programs for teachers as a model for entering the teaching profession. We're excited about this opportunity because these are high quality models rooted in extensive classroom experience. The earn and learn model of apprenticeship takes away the affordability barrier, but particularly impacts recruitment and retention of our educators of color. It creates pathways into the profession for those that already have education experience, like paraprofessionals who previously couldn't afford to get on the path of becoming a teacher. And it can be used to scale already high quality programs like Grow Your Own programs and residency programs. With the Department of Labor and the White House, we launched an effort last August to increase the number of these programs in our states, and are really excited that while we had two when we launched that effort together last August, we're now up to 19 states that have registered apprenticeship programs. And it really shows the type of progress and innovation that we can drive when we have partners at the federal level coming together and when we have an amazing coalition of organizations representing our states, to the American Federation of Teachers, National Education Association, our institutions of higher education, coming together to all say, yeah, this is a space in which we're interested in doing more work together. So that's just a little bit about what the department is doing right now as we think about education, as we think about labor shortages and particularly impacting our schools, but I'm eager to get into conversation.
Thank you so much, Maureen. I really appreciate that. So it's great to have you both with us. As I mentioned, we've received a lot of questions from our network. I want to build on what you just both talked about a little bit before we get into some of the kind of pipeline questions we got, going back to even like K through 12, right? So Manny, would you like to just jump in and share a little bit too about apprenticeships and what you're seeing in terms of the Department of Labor's focus on some of the things you mentioned, like childcare and teachers?
Absolutely. Thank you for that, Liz. And I'll be succinct because I could probably talk for a few hours on our collaboration with the Department of Education and federal agencies across the administration. But I'll just say succinctly that the first thing that's helped us be in terms of our strategy is partnering really closely with other federal agencies, in particular the Department of Education, and seeing it as a whole government approach. And then two, engaging external stakeholders. With that said, we've made some specific investments. So you heard Mo talk about just over a year ago, we were only about 2 to 3 states, and now we're at 19 states and nearly 4 dozen teacher apprenticeship programs. And we're seeing different models, whether it's leveraging a paraprofessional and upskilling them to become teachers through the apprenticeship program, or leveraging someone already with a bachelor's degree or completing their program. So there's a variety of strategies, but those didn't happen accidentally. We've made some intentional partnerships and engagement, and we're making investments. So for example, with the Department of Education last year, we announced $80 million investments, where we're investing in both investments in states, where states are leveraging dollars to scale programs for education. They're leveraging in other sectors as well, but education was a big priority one. Two, we're also scaling opportunities with intermediaries. And I know there were some other questions around outside, for example, trucking and pieces that I'll touch upon a little bit as well in a second, but leveraging our intermediaries and providing additional investments to intermediaries. When we talk about the early childhood and childcare, our approach at the Department of Labor has been focusing on a job quality and career pathways. So that has included, one, providing guidance to our state and local workforce systems around supporting job quality in those particular sectors. But we've also, again, provided additional investments, such as we currently have an investment out now for critical sectors grants, which is $15 million to support partnerships in a particular care economy roles, in addition to others such as climate resiliency and hospitality. But that's in the funding that we have currently out right now. We previously in the past had a QEST, the acronym is Quality Jobs, Equity Strategy and Training Grants, but those were awarded last year. And so our approach has been both on a policy, how do we facilitate guidance to the field to ensure that the job training, they have the opportunity for supportive services, but as well as tangible investments that we're putting out to the field. And as we do both the policy and the investments, how are we partnering with one industry, but also quite frankly, our federal partners, such as the Department of Education, working closely with the administration to ensure that we're not moving in isolation. So just want to kind of provide that input as well.
Thank you, man. And before we get back into part of the K-12 piece, Maureen, that you mentioned, I just want to touch on those two industries you mentioned, Manny. Construction trade workers, but also commercial driver's license. We had a question from Stacy Camp, who owns a trucking company in Columbus, Ohio, specifically on the licensing cost and worker shortages there.
Absolutely. So I'll say to that, and that's a really good question. And we're actually doing a lot of work in that area. About a year ago, if you have not heard about our trucking challenge. So the reason why we're leveraging the registered apprenticeship is because we know that it's a proven model that works, where you receive paid work experience with mentorship, with education that leads to a nationally recognized credential. So with that said, about a year ago, we launched the 90-day trucking challenge with the Office of Apprenticeship. And the 90-day trucking challenge was actually to scale registered apprenticeship program and address the pipeline, the opportunity within the trucking industry specifically. And within 90 days, we were able to launch over 100 programs within about 100 programs within 90 days. And so the reason why that's also important, we've also done it in cybersecurity within 120-day cybersecurity sprint, where we've launched about 200 programs and we saw 8,000 apprentices hired within 120 days. The reason why I say that is because in those specific numbers is we also wanted to show that government could move at the speed of business and scale and launch these programs rapidly. Now, specific to the question around some of the costs and support, I do want to mention, if you're not familiar with it, we have an intermediary for trucking that any of your members, any organization could reach out to. They could reach out to me and I could connect them to, and it's Fastport. We leverage intermediaries such as Fastport to actually support and provide direct support to organizations. So for trucking in particular, we actually work with those associations with Fastport to work with trucking companies on the ground. But there are some investments or some strategies that you could leverage as well for funding to offset the cost of funding. One is leveraging Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act. That's the federal workforce dollars. So if you are familiar with the education, how the dollars flow, we have, the acronym is WIOA. But you can leverage those dollars to support costs such as licensing and certification. Two, what we've seen is leveraging Pell Grants to support CDL training, depending on the school. Three, we've seen, and again, our Fastport intermediary can support with this, leveraging GI benefits that have also helped offset the cost. Four, state and community colleges, working with the state and community colleges that often provide low to no cost support. And so I have even specific examples in Georgia where residents who are attending Georgia Public Technical College, they can earn a certificate or diploma and are eligible for a HOPE grant regardless of their grade average. So those are, and then the fifth thing I'll add just as a specific, again, where you can get those funding and how you can support is, we've often seen that if you go through the registered apprenticeship program, the carrier, the insurance often can provide a lower rate. So in addition to that, WIOA has been a source that you can leverage to support that, Pell Grants, GI benefits, and some state-specific ones as well.
I think the big takeaway there is there are far more resources than I realized for each specific industry you got questions about. So we'll be sure to follow up with folks afterwards too. I want to get back to the education piece, especially K-12. And I'll start with you, Maureen. You talked about it already in your opening remarks. I'm going to give you a chance to maybe drill down a little bit more into specifics. How are you thinking through getting youth into training and development programs, employment opportunities to prepare them for future shortages, right? We're talking about labor shortages today, but how are we thinking through K-12 to anticipate what's going to come in the coming generations?
That's helpful. Thank you. So last year, the Secretary Cardona, along with then Secretary of Labor, Secretary Walsh, issued a Dear Colleague letter that called on our workforce systems and our education systems to work together. At the national level, we're doing it. And it really says, hey, at the state and local level, you should be doing that too. And that includes establishing relationships between local school districts and local workforce boards and organizations to do exactly that kind of work around making sure that when we think about educating our young people, that we're tying it up to where the jobs are coming, as you said, not just where they are today. That sort of career success, career connection piece, as I mentioned, is also one of the key six goals within our Raise the Bar work. So with the Department of Labor, we've launched the Unlocking Career Success Initiative, which is an interagency initiative that reimagines how our nation's high schools can prepare all students to thrive in their future careers. That's just a joint effort with DOL, as I mentioned, but also with Commerce to support public and private sector leaders, government agencies, and other community-based organizations to help our students earn post-secondary degrees and industry credentials that our employers need and that our economies demand. And it really has four keys. First, dual enrollment. So we're getting our high school students to get that college exposure and course credit before they're graduating from high school. Work-based learning opportunities while our students are still in high school, opportunities to earn industry credentials, stronger career advisement and post-secondary support. And as a department, we're providing a range of supports to school districts and states that are doing this, including technical assistance, a range of playbooks for leaders engaged in this space, state convenings, and we've also launched a new Career Connected High School grant program. That'll be a $25 million award for grantees to jumpstart or advance their work, advancing college and career pathways. So we're really trying to make stronger connections for high school students to college and career, again, while they're still in high school. And then in addition, I would say we're really broadly supporting CTE in a bunch of ways. More than half of all of our students now in grades 9 to 12 are enrolled in career and technical education coursework. And there's an opportunity for states to really show leadership there as well. So it's a space that we're really excited about. The secretary went to a vocational high school and really believes in the power of that model. And it's something that we're excited about. And I'll just say, for this, the businesses on the line, we might talk about this again later, but get engaged with your school district. If you have opportunities to engage students in your community, young people in your community, get engaged with your school district. As a former local school district employee, I can tell you there's such a desire for partnership from school districts with local business leaders, with local nonprofits, and there are opportunities there. So engage.
Something we've heard in past briefings on this topic is that typically the agencies or the policymakers look to industry first to identify the gaps anyway. So getting involved with your school district early means you get ahead of whatever future workforce gap you're anticipating too, which is helpful. Manny, anything to add to that before we move into some of the certifications?
The only thing I'd add is only building, since Mo said get involved with your local school district, I'd be remiss if I didn't also add, if you're not involved or not familiar with your state and local workforce boards, you should also get involved with your state and local workforce boards for two reasons. Again, whether you're small, medium, or large. One is, as part of, on the policy side, they're actually required to have industry engagement. That's a fundamental requirement. But more, quite frankly, selfishly for your business, is that you can help shape the skills, the credentials. And this is coming from someone that used to sit on the state workforce board, and the businesses can influence what are the priority occupations, what are the skills, what are the certifications, and then leverage the state and local workforce system to better understand the funding. So most of our dollars that flows through, they go from the federal Department of Labor, they then go to state workforce boards and then go to local workforce boards. Similar to how you would think about a state school board and a local school board, it's a very similar pathway. But by being engaged and sitting on a state or local workforce board or getting involved with them, you could have a much more influence on the policy and the funding implementation side as well. So I just add that.
That's very helpful and a great segue into some questions we got on actual certifications, whether teaching or other professionals as certifications. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on areas that you're seeing some good movement in terms of helping to certify folks earlier for some of these labor shortages, but also what you need to hear from business in terms of what they need.
Sounds good. I would jump in by saying a few things, and this also goes across sectors. And you'll probably notice that there's a theme that is very consistent within this, which is that in terms of the certifications, there's several like pathways or strategies. One is within the registered apprenticeship system, right? So we know that the apprentices earn nationally recognized credentials. You can leverage a variety of funding that I've already mentioned. But let's say separately, you know, if you're looking at some broader sectors, we have discretionary dollars in investment. So for example, let's say in infrastructure and construction, we actually currently have $80 million out right now. That because it's currently open, I couldn't speak to individual companies about it, but it is open. It's on our site. I could provide that link to you, Liz, to share out. But you can come together and create partnerships. So sector strategies is something within the workforce system that we've seen effective. So creating a sector strategy or sector partnership, what that really means is that coming together with a group of organizations, partner with workforce, partner with education, to articulate, here's how we want to, you know, support and engage our workforce and build a pipeline, particularly for your openings. And you could leverage then those dollars to not only support training, but also the certifications as well. Again, within WIOA, that's actually something that's already supported, quite frankly, within WIOA. And again, WIOA is the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act. And, you know, on the operational level with the state and local board, you can absolutely leverage some of those to do that as well. So I think kind of big picture, we have current investments out. If outside of our investment, you can leverage the registered apprenticeship system. Outside of the registered apprenticeship system, you can really go and work with your partners at the state and local level, and we can help facilitate those pieces. But, you know, if I take a step back, one of the things we often ask all of our grantees and our state and local partners that we oversee is to frame the needs. What is the need? So if you, and then the two is around the skills, because we know that one of the things that we want to move away from is the train and pray model to a train and hire where industry is involved on the front end and we're addressing their specific labor market needs. We also have investments when we think about the clean energy, as you all may already be familiar with some of the current landscape in the Inflation Reduction Act. If you have a prevailing wage and registered apprenticeship, you have a 5X fold in benefit by leveraging prevailing wage registered apprenticeship, 5X fold of benefit, and we're helping to implement that. So that's a slight tangent, but all that to say is that there's a variety of investments, tools, and resources to do that. We also have, just only other thing I mentioned is we have a partner finder on our website where the Partner Finder actually can help you identify both training programs or apprenticeship programs that you can connect with in your particular zip code as well.
Thanks so much, Manny. I'll just add on to that. Of course, certification requirements for teaching vary from state to state. That's the way our system works. If folks on the line or your spouse, your partner, your child, your aunt, your cousin, your intern is interested in becoming a teacher, a great way to get started is going to www.teach.org. Teach.org is a nonprofit founded by the Department of Education and Microsoft previously. And it really provides a lot of great information on understanding the certification requirements in your state, understanding how to choose a high quality program and provide support in navigating that process. So would really encourage folks to look there.
Thank you both so much. I think that's a good way for us to enter more once people are certified, once people are ready to actually have these jobs. How are the employers able to find them? How are they able to keep them? So I'd love to start with a question from Connie Russell, who's the CEO of a group actually out of DC. And Connie asks, many small businesses today, like hers, are experiencing challenges in recruiting, retaining quality employees. What are the barriers that you're seeing or that you're trying to solve from your perspectives? And how can employers help identify and secure those employees today? I mean, I'd love to start with you. That feels like an appropriate Department of Labor question.
It is. So I think there's two specific things that we're seeing. And I mean, there's several others, but I'll say two things and how we're thinking about it. I think when we talk about the specific to Connie's question around the recruiting and retaining quality employees, we see challenges and opportunity within supportive services. So oftentimes, I've seen this directly where an individual is pursuing a training program where they're starting an employment, or they're going to a training program, but it's a cost of transportation, maybe it's childcare, maybe it's and those other things that may seem peripheral is actually what's impacting either the recruiting or the retention space. So the first thing I would say is the supportive services. And with there, we have a strategy. And again, all of those other investments that I mentioned and many more, we explicitly call out supportive services as something that funds can be used for. In addition to, again, if you're working with your state and local workforce board, well, you can leverage those. So one is I would say, the issues or challenges around supportive services, quite frankly. A second one I would say is something where we see and we're pushing on is around skills-based hiring. Because sometimes when the labor market is tight, there's more of a focus on it, especially now with the historically low unemployment rate of the administration, quite frankly, we're seeing more openings to that. But oftentimes we see kind of arbitrary degree requirements or requirements that may or may not fully align. So one of the things that we're pushing on is this focus on skills-based hiring. So the skills-based hiring, and this is the connection with registered apprenticeship, is that you're actually pursuing and developing skills. And if you're pursuing a credential, that it actually aligns to the occupation and the job that you're pursuing. And it's not just an arbitrary requirement, particularly when we think about the broader kind of cost conversation. So I think the second one I would say is around skills-based hiring. And the third piece here is quite frankly around the recruitment challenge and retention is just broader awareness. Right. And this is where we're working particularly around on a youth strategy and kind of a broader kind of strategy with incumbent workers is stakeholders or folks may not be aware of the opportunities or many of these things that we're talking about. So we're elevating these messages and sharing out. So I would say supportive services as an important kind of recruiting and retention challenge, skills-based hiring, making sure that it's actually aligned and there's engagement on the front end. And then third, kind of the broader awareness aspect as well. And then again, with the quality connects to the apprenticeship as well. Go ahead, Mo.
Yeah, Manny, I was actually going to prompt you further. Do you want to talk a little bit about the importance of supportive services during the training process and how apprenticeship funding can be used to support that?
Absolutely. Going back to that point around the supportive services. And so the framing that I mentioned around, we often see that as a barrier or it can be a barrier within the registered apprenticeship program. You can leverage dollars. And this is one of the many beauties of the registered apprenticeship program. So whether we're talking about registered apprenticeship in this context for teachers, but also other occupations as well, once you're in a registered apprenticeship program, and this might seem super kind of technical and nerdy, but you can be automatically added to the eligible training provider list in any state. What all that means is that now it makes it easier to facilitate the process of getting funds for supportive services by having a bona fide DOL registered apprenticeship, registered with a state apprenticeship agency or the Office of Apprenticeship, So there's additional dollars that's available. So that includes the WIOA dollars that I mentioned earlier, but that includes additional discretionary grant dollars. In some instances, it can include where states, and those are state specific to be clear, there's instances where states provide additional funding to leverage supportive services as well. So there's a variety of pieces that can support the supportive services component. In addition, I'll actually even add that with the whole government approach, we're working closely, and one of my other colleagues kind of lead this work. We work closely with the Department of Transportation, Department of Energy, and their investments that they're putting out to ensure that supportive services is a use of funds or a certain percentage can be used to support training in those areas as well. When we talk about infrastructure and energy and broader.
Maureen, anything to add there in terms of the teacher retention or recruitment side? I know you outlined some of the key pillars in your intro remarks.
Yeah, so obviously when it comes to both recruiting and retaining our teachers, compensation is critical, working conditions is critical, and that can mean a lot of different things. Sometimes it's the built physical environment of our school facilities, which in too many cases, especially in our high poverty communities, are not what they should be. And just like you or I, if we're in an office building that doesn't feel safe or doesn't feel clean, that's gonna make us not feel great and supported. Educators feel just the same way when their school facilities don't feel clean. So we have those issues there. Creating environments, just like for everybody else, that are supportive, where they feel that they're respected and treated with dignity. You know, too many of the actions we're now seeing in some places, I'll say, are not treating teachers with respect they need. And that's a real issue. And we know that the same thing is true in any workplace. President Biden has really centered treating workers with dignity and respect as foundational to the economy that we're trying to build here. And that's true for workers, regardless of the profession. And the same thing is true for educators. So there's a range of things when we talk about working conditions, and certainly I think they parallel our other sectors as well.
Thank you both so much. I think we have covered a lot about how kind of the role of government, right? You've mentioned resources available, how your agencies specifically are thinking about some of these staffing challenges. I just want to make sure we include how businesses can get involved and how they're meant to either complement or fill in for some of these gaps too. So we had a question from Tanisha Jones out of Houston, Texas. She's a business owner of a company called Search and Staff. Tanisha asked, are agencies considering using outside resources, right? You talked about supportive services, but are they considering outside resources, staffing agencies, other vendors, specifically through government contracts as an example, to assist with the actual staffing and filling of these open jobs due to labor shortages? Man, I'd love to send it to you.
No problem. Our main piece here on this specific question is that how we're working with external stakeholders to build capacity. And in there, the specific one is our, in what I reference is intermediaries. And so when you hear the term intermediaries, these are external organizations that we actually subcontract with to scale registered apprenticeships. And this is why when I mentioned earlier about our investment that we made or that we are making in education, that's, for example, the scaled and intermediary specific that really has that focus and expertise in K-12 teacher education, as well as early childhood, so that they can work directly with states. So the way we're thinking about it specifically is actually working with intermediaries in particular sectors. We actually have both intermediaries and technical assistance centers. Just really quickly, the main piece here is that the intermediaries, we have 16 in specific sectors where their sole focus is, so for example, cybersecurity, hospitality, advanced manufacturing, construction, trucking, and we have a variety of intermediaries that we actually subcontract to build capacity. So what they do is they work directly with employers to help scale and develop and register apprenticeship programs. But we also have a couple of technical assistance centers. So for example, for DEIA, let's say your organization really wants to scale apprenticeships and really wants to better understand and think about DEIA as a center. Well, you could partner with GFF, which is one of our DEIA technical assistance centers that specifically work with organizations to enhance, develop apprenticeships in the context of DEIA. So we have both intermediaries for sectors and as well as technical assistant centers for a particular function. But that's the way, in terms of the external partners, that's how we are approaching, and that's how we think about it outside of, which, again, I'll just continue to reiterate this, that employers themselves, they really, really can be a driver in their state and local level. So for example, states have to develop state plans on workforce every 4 years. And actually the next one is coming up. In any state that you're in, you could really work with your states to really say, I want to be more involved in developing the state plan because it's a requirement to engage industry, particularly employers, as part of that state plan. So the employers can help drive the vision, drive the engagement, and how they want to see the workforce develop. They could also do that at the local level with their local workforce boards and the local workforce plans, which also has a requirement to have industry engagement as well.
That's great. Thank you, Manny. I'm conscious of time, so I just want to make sure I wrap up some of the things that we've heard so far in your questions. Typically, we end with how business leaders can get involved. You've been layering that into every answer you've had so far, so thank you so much. I just want to reflect back what I heard and give you a chance to add anything else. So I heard folks, if they want to demonstrate demand or need for workforce talent development or labor shortages, get involved with your school board, get involved with your state or local workforce boards, help advise on state plans. I also heard about creating some sector strategies with their peers in terms of maybe some of the resources you mentioned, Department of Labor. Am I missing anything for how business leaders can get involved today?
Yeah, I would just say it's really important to hear from the business community about the importance of investments in public education, about the importance of increasing pay for teachers. You are critical leaders in your communities whose voices matter. I think everybody's used to folks in education saying, we need more funding for our schools, or we need to pay our teachers more. And it's really critical that other voices that share that view make that known as well, especially as we recover from the pandemic. Our schools have made great use of our COVID relief funding. Those will be expiring over the next couple of years. If we want to continue the dramatic increases in summer learning programs, after school programs, tutoring, mentoring programs. I know many of you are parents and yourselves are caretakers of kids. Investments in public education is how that happens. So would just encourage you to get involved at the local level with your schools and decisions about how our schools are funded and supported.
I would just quickly ditto Mo. It's almost as if you read my mind on the investment part. I think that was the only other piece we want to elevate. Both our existing investments that we have out currently in a variety of sectors and our investment that we have in education. And then two, our future investments, they have a specific requirements to engage industry. So I think to Mo's point, when you think about working with the Department of Labor, when you think about even, you know, partners on the ground, businesses, you know, are front and center in terms of the priority. So you can go and engage those partners and say, you know, how you want to engage with them because those are requirements in our investments. And so that's, I would just add that investment piece that our current investment we have out and future investment that we have that will be upcoming requires that industry engagement and partnership. So industry can elevate their voice and continue to speak to the value benefits of those investments, but also for the existing investments to go to the partners on the ground and say, here's how we want to be involved, how we want to support. Like there's opportunities within those to do that.
Thank you both so much. We really appreciate your time. And it's clear how much not only the two of you work together, but your departments work together too in terms of addressing labor shortages, whether with teachers or in the other professional groups. So once again, thank you so much for joining us. We're very appreciative of your time. And for those that were able to join us live, we hope you can join us for our next briefing. Please keep out for more information from us, including the resources discussed on this call today. So again, thank you to Manny, Maureen, and everyone who joined today's briefing. We look forward to working with you again very soon.
Thank you everyone for joining us. For more information on Business Forward programming, visit businessfwd.org. The Business Forward podcast is a production of Business Forward, hosted by me, Jim Doyle, produced and engineered by Alexi Lemon. Thanks for listening. See you next time.